Like really what we found was that the cardiovascular adaptations that were occurring in the powerlifters that we studied weren't necessarily a training adaptation per se. It was more a combination of they were already skilled at this particular task we were asking them to do. They already held a lot of trunk muscle mass, which then we know is correlated with respiratory muscle strength and the ability to generally take big breaths and generate a large amount of expiratory pressure. So I think that, if people were just being generally healthful, doing their cardio, keeping reasonably fit and well, I don't see how that would negatively impact your ability to continue to generate high intrathoracic pressures in order to splint to do a big lift. I mean, if anything, if you had good cardiovascular fitness, I would speculate that you'd just be able to take bigger breaths and hold them for a longer amount of time, and then thus generating more intrathoracic pressure.
Okay, Kate, welcome to Evidence Strong Show. It's my pleasure to have you, and please introduce yourself briefly.
Yeah, sure. So my name's Kate Drury. I'm a cardiopulmonary physiology researcher. I'm also a powerlifter. So I've competed in powerlifting for about 10 years. And so basically, how I got into this type of research was I have quite a multidisciplinary clinical background. So I'm a clinical nurse specialist in emergency nursing and also an accredited exercise physiologist. And basically why I was interested in Valsalva physiology was I was seeing it in a few different contexts. So we actually use Valsalvas in emergency to revert arrhythmias. And I was basically thinking, wow, we can have this profound impact on the cardiovascular system just by modifying our breathing. So I wonder how that impacts the cardiovascular physiology of people who do it just in an athletic sense, because powerlifters, weightlifters, people who resistance train use Valsalva maneuvers all the time. So that basically led to my master's thesis, which was looking at cardiovascular adaptations to repeated Valsalva maneuvers in powerlifters. And basically the paper that we're going to discuss is the product of that study. But
Awesome.
that's me. Cardiopulmonary clinical type stuff is my interest.
Amazing. I have spent a few months looking for researcher like you, so I'm super excited. I will just mention the explicitly the name of the paper, Effects of Intensity and Training on Cardiovascular Responses to the Valsalva Maneuver.
Yeah,
So
that's right.
we are discussing, and I think we have to start at the beginning and discuss physiologically what Valsalva Maneuver is and what happens mechanically and in terms of reflexes or autonomic response. Let's go science.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. So I'm just going to share my screen to show you a diagram.
Awesome.
So for anybody who is wondering where this diagram came from, we actually drew up an idealized response to Valsalva maneuvers based on our literature review and some of the pilot work that we were doing in the lab. And this actually is pulled from one of our figures in the paper. So if you've read the paper, you'll recognize it from the methods. So basically, what you're looking at here is on the y-axis, you've got the cardiovascular response, and we're looking at two different responses within the same plot. So the blood pressure, we're talking about blood pressure globally there, both systolic and diastolic blood pressures behave the same way within the Valsalva maneuver. So your blood pressure there is the dotted line, and that's obviously measured in millimeters of mercury. And then the solid line is the heart rate response measured in beats per minute.
Could you just clarify for everyone what is a systolic and diastolic blood pressure?
Yeah, absolutely. So most people know that their blood pressure is made up of two different numbers. So the systolic blood pressure is the number on the top. So you might hear people talk about, say, their blood pressure being 120 over 80. So 120 is systolic blood pressure. And systolic means that that's the resistance exerted on the vessels when the heart's in systole or when it's ejecting blood. And the diastolic blood pressure, that bottom number on that equation, the 120 out of 80, is basically the same thing, the amount of pressure exerted on the arteries, but when the heart's in diastole, so when it's relaxed and in its filling phase. So it just looks at the two different components of the cardiac cycle in ejection and relaxation.
Thank you.
So that's our y-axis. And then along the x-axis down the bottom, we're looking in time in seconds. So in the research context, obviously we have to be super controlled in the methods that we take in doing stuff like this. So when I talk about Valsalva physiology, we're looking on a time course of about 15 seconds. Obviously, when we're out in the gym and doing our different lifts and stuff, our Valsalvas can last for a varying amount of time. But in the research context, we just have to make everybody do it the exact same way every single time. So that is still a little bit of an unknown. We don't know a lot if the cardiovascular responses are exactly the same in shorter time courses or longer ones. But if you look at the Valsalva physiology research more broadly, 15 seconds is a really standardized time period. All right, cool. So if we have a look at our graph, basically this flat line is before you've started the Valsalva. So you're just normal breathing pattern, your breathing and your heart rate and your blood pressure all controlled by respiratory sinus arrhythmia, which is a normal physiological process where basically as you breathe in, your heart rate trends up, and as you breathe out, your heart rate trends back down. So that's our baseline. And what will happen is, as all lifters know, you take that really nice big breath in, fill your thorax and your abdomen with air, and then you basically splint out isometrically in your abdomen and or a belt. So that's when the Valsalva begins, when you begin that isometric hold. And you're sort of doing a isometric, isovolumic expiratory breath. So we've cut the Valsalva into a few different phases here. So phase one, if we look at the top here, that's basically just a few cardiac cycles long, so a few heartbeats. And what's happening there is you're getting that big rise in intrathoracic pressure, and that is starting to build compression on the heart itself and the roots of the great vessels. So those are things like your aorta, your pulmonary trunk, your superior and inferior vena cava, because they sit really nice and tightly around in your central circulation. So as we build that big intrathoracic pressure, the heart and those vessels start to get compressed. So because they're being compressed, the aortic pressure goes up, and then you get a little bit of a compensatory decrease. So that's kind of what we're seeing here, this increase in the blood pressure and a decrease in the heart rate. Mm-hmm. Then you're going to move into phase two. So remember that phase one is really short, only a couple of cardiac cycles. So we're into phase two now, and then this is the main chunk of the Valsalva maneuver itself. Now, because you've got that ongoing intrathoracic pressure, that compression on the vessels, your venous return and your cardiac output are now compromised. So that amount of blood volume is becoming reduced. And you can see between phase one and phase two, there's now a reciprocal change. So the blood pressure is actually starting to trend down, and the heart rate is starting to trend up. That's, a result of aortic pressure now decreasing. So that's why the blood pressure falls. And then you get a compensatory behavior in the heart rate. That's, reasonably transient. It's physiological, not pathological. So we don't need to worry too much. So as I said, in the research context, we're looking at this on a time course of about 15 seconds. So we told our participants to let go of their Valsalva maneuver at the 15 second mark. And that's what indicates that we're now into phase three. What's interesting about phase three is that the cardiovascular system is still responding, even though we've taken the expiratory stimulus away. So we've got intrathoracic pressure is now moving back down towards baseline, not all the way back yet, but it's on its way down. That means that that pressure on the aorta has come back down as well, and you're seeing another drop in the blood pressure. It's a little bit, goes down even further than what it was in phase two. And again, a nice little compensatory rise in the heart rate. Much like phase one, this one is quite short too. And what we see then is the movement into phase four. Now, we don't know, when I say we, I mean like the royal we in terms of cardiovascular scientists. Nobody really quite knows exactly how long phase four lasts for. It's kind of speculated that it might have something to do with the cardiovascular health of the participant at a baseline. So people who are generally a bit healthier, have more elastic vessels, would probably return to phase four a bit quicker. But it's not kind of objectively saying like, yep, at this time point you would be in phase four or return to baseline. It's just a general trend back. So what happens by the time we get to phase four is the intrathoracic pressure rise has basically totally dissipated. You're back on the way to your baseline, however much pressure you would normally hold in your chest. And what that means is then all that venous return that couldn't return before is going to surge back into the central circulation. So you get a nice big sweep up in the blood pressure, and then the heart rate slows down to try to accommodate that excess blood volume. That being said, you know, there are some variables in depending on who you're looking at, what kind of time course, but generally this is what we would expect to see in a normal healthy person lying down doing a controlled bowel salvo maneuver. One of the questions that I did have when we were kind of running this study is, this doesn't actually account for any changes in posture at all. So in the research context, obviously people are attached to a whole lot of different stuff. You know, we had 12-lead ECG, we had finger arterial blood pressure, we were also doing echocardiography on all of our participants. So it meant that they were all lying in a semi-recumbent position, but people don't powerlift or Olympic lift in the semi-recumbent position. So there are still some remaining questions about if this cardiovascular behavior would change at all. For example, if the person was lying down doing a bench press or if they were bent over doing a deadlift, because obviously your posture has a little bit to do with the way that your blood volume is distributed. So that's still a question that's hanging in the air.
Yes, thank you. So just to clarify, phase one is...
The phase one starts from the moment that you hold the breath. So the inspiration part kind of precedes that. So the inspiration would kind of occur here before where that dotted line is. That's when the expiration would start, or the actual Valsalva maneuver itself. So all the things that are occurring between these two vertical dotted lines is expiration or Valsalva.
Okay. Awesome. And three and four is response after the maneuver is finished.
Correct. So phase three starts as soon as you've let go of that breath, where you're trying to return to your normal breathing pattern.
Awesome. Okay, this is clear. So now, could you tell us what you exactly did in the study, who were the participants, and all the details of method section?
Yeah, absolutely. So basically in the study, what we did was recruit powerlifters who had at least 3 years training history. We wanted the difference between the two groups to be as clear as possible. So we excluded anybody who was kind of recreationally doing resistance training exercise, because we know that, you know, when people go to the gym, even if they're not trained in Valsalva, often subconsciously they'll find themselves holding their breath through the difficult part of a lift. And we didn't want that at all. So the sedentary group was made up of people who didn't exercise at all. They could play kind of like recreational team sports, you know, go for a walk for general health and things like that, but we didn't want them doing any kind of rigid exercise. So the sedentary group were completely sedentary from a resistance training point of view, and the powerlifters had a three-year training history, couldn't be on any performance enhancing drugs or anything like that. They also had to have a regular menstrual cycle, so we could test them within the first 3 days of their follicular phase. No smoking, no alcohol on a regular basis. So participant-wise, what we wanted was, you know, 18 to 50 had been in the sport for at least 3 years, were reasonably regular competitors, so not somebody who kind of just casually participated in powerlifting, but people who were very well versed in how to perform a Valsalva maneuver, you know, were aware of how uncomfortable it can be, how long to hold it, how to generate those really big expiratory pressures. Why we wanted them to have a regular menstrual cycle, we basically just said it just needs to be regular enough that so you can predict when you're going to be in your follicular phase to come in and be tested. Because the reflex behavior in that particular part of the menstrual cycle is the closest to how male reflexes behave. So we just wanted to use that to make sure there wasn't any deviation that we weren't controlling for, because one of our questions was around if the cardiovascular changes were dependent on sex or not.
Okay, so how many power lifters and how many?
So we had 8 powerlifters, I think, from memory. We had 8 powerlifters and 6 people in the control group.
Okay, so now we want to know, they came to your lab and what did you ask them to do?
Yeah, okay. So in the lab, basically what the participants needed to do was come in for a familiarization session, because when you run an experimental protocol, especially when you're using people who are sedentary and naive to a very, very specific pattern of breathing, sometimes that can bring with it a lot of anxiety for people. You know, if you're not somebody who is a lifter, trying to think about breathing against resistance does actually take some training in and of itself. So we didn't want the experimental results to be muddied by the skill deficit. So basically people agreed to be part of the study and came in for the familiarization session, where they were hooked up to all of our equipment and then basically taught how to do a Valsalva maneuver on this funny breathing apparatus that we made to simulate the resistance that your abdomen would normally generate. But we built a little mouthpiece with a piece of tubing, and it was resisted to about 90%. Again, so we were controlling every single controllable that we could. And basically that just went, the familiarization went for as long as it took them to develop that skill set. Most people didn't take any more than about 30 or 45 minutes. And then they were just run through the experimental procedure, knowing what to expect when they were going to come in for their actual testing session. So when they returned for testing, basically they just sat really, really quietly in the lab. It was pretty dark because we were doing ultrasound while we just collected all of their baseline data. So as I said, they were on 12-lead ECG, finger arterial blood pressure, and also echocardiographic images. So we were doing chest heart ultrasound through their chest wall at the same time. So once we had collected enough of their resting data, they were on a little, it's like a car seat built into a swing. I'll see if I can find a picture for you, but my supervisor built it for the lab. And basically they would sit in there.
Amazing.
Yeah. So yeah, they would basically sit kind of semi-reclined, tilted to the left because we were collecting ultrasound. So tilting them to the left meant that their anatomical structures could move a little bit further towards the chest wall, and it made getting the image easier. And basically they in real time were shown their little target screen. So I'd marked out the 30% and the 50% of their maximum expiratory pressures. And basically they were asked to do a 15-second Valsalva maneuver at 30%. Then they would get a minute recovery, then another one at 30, minute recovery, then one at 50% recovery, and another one at 50% again. So yeah, and for the sake of, you know, reliability and retesting, then all of the participants were tested twice, and anybody that kind of had any disruptions in their data, those particular testing sessions were redone. So not everybody needed to be retested three times, but, you know, some people came in and it was just like a really hot day, so they were sweaty, so the electrodes wouldn't stick, or they became a bit vasovagal, so doing the breathing maneuver made them a bit dizzy. So we needed to kind of account for that stuff as well. So a few of them had, like retests or physiological glitches, I say. So our study kind of looked at the two main questions were around training and intensity. So obviously training was the powerlifters versus the sedentary group. In the pilot study, what we found was that heart rate is a positive function of increased effort and increased expiratory pressure, which, you know, in the pilot study, we were limited. So we only looked at heart rate, but you can kind of draw a parallel between heart rate and blood pressure. So heart rate is behaving in a certain way. You kind of get an idea of what blood pressure is going to do. So when we had the powerlifters in, we were looking at their baseline measures. So as I said, so statistically, their baseline expiratory pressures were significantly higher than the sedentary group. Now, when we looked at all of the data, what we found was that there was significant differences in heart rate, systolic blood pressure, and diastolic blood pressure responses in the powerlifters versus the sedentary group. Now, overall, the cardiovascular pattern was the same. So kind of in that diagram that I was showing in the beginning, the nature of the behavior was the same, but they started from a lower low and went to a higher high in all of their cardiovascular variables. What we basically found in terms of the powerlifting difference is that it's basically the same as what other people have found in other contexts of isometric exercise when you're looking at cardiovascular parameters. So, you know, there's a couple of landmark studies in exercise science that were done back in the 80s looking at grip isometric contractions and quadricep isometric contractions and the cardiovascular pattern that occurs in those kind of contexts is exactly the same as what we see in Valsalva maneuvers. So even though it's not a skeletal muscle task kind of per se, the fact that it's a isometric muscular contraction in a different kind of way, the cardiovascular system responds exactly the same. We also didn't want to discount the contribution that skill had in that that outcome as well. So, you know, along with the background in how they breathe, generally have more, you know, trunk muscle mass and stronger respiratory muscles, both inspiratory and expiratory. That was all contributing to this significant difference in their ability to generate expiratory pressure and then have a more kind of attenuated response in their cardiovascular system. So some of what we found as well was like we're starting to see a tendency for difference in one of our variables. So in systolic blood pressure in phase three, I think it was, we could see that there was some variation, but the sample size wasn't quite big enough for it to give us a definitive answer. You know, obviously our end total was only 14. We had the joy of having our lab experiment interrupted by COVID. So 14 was the number of people that we had recruited at the time the university said, please stop coming, like the university is closed. So that was the data that we were kind of like left with to interpret. So what was interesting about that though was because of that was occurring in phase three. So we know that the Valsalva maneuver is stopped, but the cardiovascular system is still going. And what was interesting about that is that that particular phase has a lot to do with how compliant your vessels are. So resistance trained athletes as a general rule have a bit more arterial stiffness than endurance athletes and even people who are a bit more sedentary. This doesn't appear to be a problem thus far. There's not a stack of research on resistance trained athletes, particularly in terms of vessel disease or like vascular behavior. So it was really kind of difficult to draw some guidance from other researchers who'd potentially used, you know, bigger sample groups or had more specific expertise in vascular behavior. But it was super interesting to find that, you know, there is some kind of weird systolic blood pressure behavior happening in that phase in a cohort that has historically known to have stiff vessels. So that's just another question. So if anybody knows anything about strength athlete vascular behavior, I'd be really curious to hear their insight.
So can we ask you to speculate though, what could be going on, you think?
So I think that perhaps it's got something to do with like the vascular smooth muscle and its ability to stretch and relax. But perhaps it's got to do with almost the relief felt on the vessel, for want of a better word. Like, you generated all this intrathoracic pressure, especially in lifters where it's significant amount of pressure on the vasculature in the chest throughout the Valsalva, so compressed to a greater degree than in the sedentary cohort. And then the fact that you're just then releasing all of that pressure, to me, thinks maybe it has something to do with the response time in that very short window of phase three, like those few cardiac cycles. Yeah, like it's really curious. Like, I know it wasn't a significant finding because of the sample size, but I just found that really, really interesting. One of the more interesting things from the lifter's perspective, that's still like obviously a glaring hole in our research.
What was the trend specifically? Was it longer? Was it more of it? How the vessels relaxed more?
Oh, so the magnitude of the systolic blood pressure response in phase three in the powerlifters was generally quite a bit greater, but kind of variable within the powerlifter group themselves. So as I was saying, it wasn't statistically significant to the point where we could report it, you know, as a significant finding. But the fact that the phase three behavior wasn't quite the same as what we had seen in phase one and phase two, and then that interest was compounded by the fact that that's the point where the mechanical stimulus has been removed. So the cardiovascular system is going on in kind of this reflexive manner. That's kind of what I was saying in a nutshell. Yeah. I mean, we know that resistance training is great for our skeletal muscle. It's good for our bone mineral density. It's good for our sanity. So I think something that, you know, a lot of kind of lifters get caught up in is really like tying their identity really strongly to the fact that I'm a lifter. You know, I'm not super familiar with the weightlifting culture, but it's certainly the case in like powerlifting. It's almost like a meme to be a fat, stiff powerlifter, right? So, I mean, my kind of point would be, well, we know to a certain extent that strength athletes do have stiffer vessels. That's still an area that needs like a lot more work done. But broadly, that's what a lot of the literature currently says. So if it was me, I'd think, well, if I've already got slightly stiffer arteries, then really it's in my best interest and my health to do more work on my cardiovascular fitness and not be so strongly tied to the fact that, well, I'm a powerlifter and I don't do cardio. So, I mean, people get caught up in the interference effect and thinking, well, if I do, you know, 30 minutes of cardio a day, like it's going to impact negatively on my lifting. And I think that really, unless you're going to, you know, you're in a peak for nationals or you're going to the Olympics, like really we don't need to worry about it. We're all just here to have a good time, get a bit stronger. So I think doing a bit of cardio is probably not going to hurt your gains. I mean, if anything, it would help, because the fitter you are, the harder you can train for a longer amount of time, stay healthy enough to stay in the sport for long enough to get good. Because as we all know, like strength sports are truly a delayed gratification process. You got to play the long game with them, you know, hashtag lifetime intermediate. But, you know, we're not always all going to be like lifters all the time. Like I really like to go on hikes with my friends. I would like to live past 80, being able to achieve those things and being able to live like a normal healthy life, like a normal young active person, is probably more important to me than being really stuck on this idea of, well, I'm a powerlifter, so I'm not going to do any cardio. But from a purely cardiovascular, like physiological point of view, I would say, given that we don't know enough about this arterial stiffness type thing, like just keep your vessels in as good health as you possibly can.
So one more question related to that. If the athlete, let's say, will reverse the stiffness of arteries, will it affect his ability to generate pressures during Valsalva maneuver?
So I think like really what we found was that the cardiovascular adaptations that were occurring in the powerlifters that we studied weren't necessarily a training adaptation per se. It was more a combination of, they were already skilled at this particular task we were asking them to do. They already held a lot of trunk muscle mass, which then we know is correlated with respiratory muscle strength and the ability to generally take big breaths and generate a large amount of expiratory pressure. So I think that, you know, if people were just being generally healthful, doing their cardio, keeping reasonably fit and well, I don't see how that would negatively impact your ability to continue to generate high intrathoracic pressures in order to, you know, splint to do a big lift. I mean, if anything, if you had good cardiovascular fitness, I would speculate that you'd just be able to take bigger breaths and hold them for a longer amount of time and then thus generating more intrathoracic pressure, if that answers your question.
Yes, yes. Because I think the lift, like if you are a lifter, you will wonder, okay, I'm like, it's good for my health, but how it impacts my lifting. So I think I had to ask this question.
Yeah, yeah.
I have one more question. In weightlifting, it happens from time to time that the lifter is diving under the bar, pushing it up. So imagine front squat. and then they black out. Mm-hmm. Does it happen in powerlifting?
Yeah, definitely. People definitely black out in powerlifting. People definitely do pass out when, you know, you have that big intrathoracic pressure and it's like quite stimulating for your vagal nerve. And so sometimes when people have a bit of vagal sensitivity, you know, it'll just take a very small amount of difference. Even if they train all the time, if they get particularly hyped or, you know, their position was slightly different, something's just a little bit more off than it normally would be. Yeah, people can black out all the time. It happened to one of my participants in the lab while they were lying down. And it's just, you know, you're having these huge changes in your blood pressure. And then some people just aren't as adept at compensating with the heart rate sometimes.
Okay, is there anything the athlete or the coach can do when it happens? Not really to prevent, but when it happens, do you have any advice how to get the athlete to be lift ready? Like in weightlifting, they have a chance. If it's not the last lift, they can go back within possibly 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So they can redo the lift or even go up with the weight. What can the athlete and the coach do, you think, to improve the chances of succeeding the second time?
I would say, like, basically what you want to do is obviously expedite their recovery from the dip in the blood pressure, because presumably that's the part that makes them faint, is that they've held their breath for so long. And because of that vessel compression, they've impacted their venous return to a point where their brain isn't being perfused and they black out. So I would say probably put them in a position to like facilitate as much venous return as possible, which is just to like lie them down on the ground, legs in the air, get as much blood volume into that central circulation as you can. You can try and supplement with like drinking water or Gatorade or something. Like, it's really hard to know if that's going to be impactful enough in the amount of time that you have available to you in a competition. But even if this happened and they weren't going to go back out, the best way for them to get more volume is to use gravity to shunt it centrally for you, and then supplement it with external input. So drinking more volume, essentially. So, I can't think of anything that would be timely enough to get them back on the platform for a second lift.
Yeah, so what we're trying to do basically is pull or shift the blood from the legs back to the thoracic and abdominal thoracic and head.
Yeah, basically. Because when you're holding your breath and the vessel is compressed, then you're not going to get the benefit of that venous return through the compressed vessel. So you're just trying to reverse that part of it.
Awesome. Thank you. And any final advice you would have for the lifters?
I would definitely say, like, please do your cardio, you know, just for general health. I know you, like, love tying your identity to being a powerlifter, but it's cooler to live to old age rather than being a fat powerlifter. And I would probably say, just, like, out of the blue, like, if you happen to see people who are recruiting for powerlifting research or research more broadly, really, like, give it a go, because it's quite good fun to actually contribute something positive to our, like, our sports are so small, and I think that obviously contributes to the really gross lack of robust scientific research in, you know, weightlifting and powerlifting. So if you happen to see the opportunity to volunteer for a study, like, please, please, please do it. Your participation is, like, absolute gold, and it makes us, you know, one step better in doing evidence-based work for people who share the same passion as you.
Thank you so much for that. Yeah, that's such a good message. What comes next for you? Will you do more research in powerlifting?
I will do more research. I'm actually starting my PhD next week. So thank you. I'm super excited. It's been a long time coming. So I submitted my master's in the middle of 2021. And then because of COVID and everything, and there was, you know, some funding issues. So I've been waiting 18 months to get started on my PhD. So that's really exciting. It's not necessarily in the powerlifting space anymore. So my master's was a bit of a passion project for me because it was my first step into research. So I really wanted to do something that I already knew I was interested in, but my PhD will be looking at still exercise testing, but in a clinical population. So looking at heart failure patients. And then maybe when I come out the other side of that, I can come back to more like healthy pop type work.
Please do. We'll be waiting for you.
But I'll still be around, like I'm in the powerlifting space, like I referee at competitions and stuff, so it's still very much a like a big love of mine.
Awesome. Your favorite color?
My favorite color is yellow. I've got a cockatiel. She's yellow. Oh, here she is. Hello.
Hello.
That's tofu. So she's my favorite color.
All right. Noted. So I will make an infographic from your study and it will be in yellow. That's a promise.
Awesome. Thank you.
And the last question, where people can find you and follow you and your work?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter at the moment. So I think my username there is like physiologist. So the word physiologist and then the letter K and the number 8. So like physiologist Kate. Also on ResearchGate, you know, I put the paper up there. So if people want to contact for the full text, more than happy to distribute it. I'm also on Instagram where I talk like a little bit about my research, but it's mostly like science memes and cockatiels. But if people want to follow me on there, it's Kato, which is just Kato dot potato and then 2 underscores.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure. I learned a lot. I'm sure people who will be listening will be very interested to listen to our conversation. Thank you so much and see you next time.
Thank you so much for the invite, Alex. Appreciate it.